KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
This is KAEB 91.9 on your FM dial. Your one-stop shop in Sandpoint from classic oldies to banging new modern.
From KMXT in Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Madsen, delivering the essentials for everyday life in the last frontier. Learn more at madsen.com/Alaska. Statewide support of the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Satellite Technical Services, providing satellite communication solutions for commercial fishermen across the state of Alaska. Information and dealers can be found at satellitewest.com or by calling 206-321-6896.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is imposing what it calls unprecedented conservation measures to address declines of Gulf of Alaska Chinook salmon, which is currently under review for listing under the Federal Endangered Species Act. As reported by KUCB's Theo Greenlee, the department said in an announcement on March 18th that it will be restricting Western Alaska king salmon fisheries, including in Kodiak, Chignik, and Sand Point. Matt Keyes is an area management biologist at Fish and Game's Sand Point office. He says this is the first time the department has used data from one region to trigger management action in another.
And that is unprecedented from managing a fishery based on fish that are not found locally to the systems in the area in which we're harvesting fish.
Sand Point, off the Alaska Peninsula, is in the middle of the management region known as Area M. And although it doesn't have its own king runs, fishermen intercept salmon that migrate through the region. In recent years, Area M's harvest levels have drawn criticism from stakeholders in Western Alaska who argue the fishery reduces local salmon returns. Keyes says genetic sampling shows much of the Chinook harvested in the South Peninsula fishery actually come from the Pacific Northwest. He added that the new management approach reflects a broader effort to distribute conservation burdens more evenly across the regions that encounter Gulf of Alaska Chinook. Recent Chinook-related closures have also taken place elsewhere in the state. Last year, the fleet in the federally managed Central Gulf of Alaska pollock fishery, which is based mostly out of Kodiak, voluntarily ended its season when Chinook bycatch reached a specified threshold. Keyes says the department is looking at ways to try to boost Chinook stocks throughout the Gulf, and additional measures could affect other fisheries.
Everyone that's catching fish is going to bear a little bit of that burden, at least in the westward region.
The current planned restrictions apply only to purse seiners and are limited to July, but Keyes says the management plan could evolve based on in-season harvest numbers.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
The harvest allocation for king salmon in southeast Alaska is lower than the region's commercial trawlers expected. As reported by KCAW's Catherine Rose, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game announced on April 1st that 130,000 treaty Chinook salmon will be available this year for all southeast fisheries, down almost 40% from last year's allocation. From that total, trawlers are allowed to catch 92,000 king salmon. The balance of treaty salmon goes primarily to sport anglers. Sitkin Matt Donahoe is the vice chair of the Alaska Trawlers Association.
It's pretty bad news. We heard that it's going to be lower than last year, but we didn't know how much. It's a devastating number. It's the worst ever. I mean, what industry can afford a 40% reduction?
He says it's the lowest number in the history of the Pacific Salmon Treaty.
I hope the treaty folks are mistaken, because it'd be even worse if they're not mistaken, if the fish are in that kind of trouble. But I think the process is flawed.
The U.S. and Canada established the Pacific Salmon Treaty in 1985 to regulate the commercial and recreational harvest of king salmon in coastal waters from Alaska to Oregon. The process for determining harvest numbers has evolved over the years and recently has used catch rates from winter king fishing to establish the numbers for the summer season. Regardless of the method, however, the result has been a downward trend in commercial harvest rates over most of the last four decades. Recently, chum salmon have equaled or bettered kings as a moneymaker for southeast trawlers, but Donahoe says chum and coho can't be relied on to save small boat fishermen. Kings, historically, have been trawlers' bread and butter.
With the price of coho was so bad last year that a lot of guys didn't go fishing. And it was just cheap to go chum fishing. And they had pretty good chum fishing here in Sitka Sound, but you can't count on that.
The impact of the lower-than-expected harvest allocation on trawlers is further compounded by a new distribution of Alaska's treaty kings. Trawlers' share of the salmon was reduced by the Alaska Board of Fisheries at its February meeting this year from 80 to 77%, with the 3% difference going to sport fishermen. But the allocation news means sport fishermen will be hit too. Donahoe says, quote, "They're going to have a lower bag limit. Everybody's in this boat." Close quote. The summer season for commercial trolling opens on July 1st. Many trollers take to the water much earlier, however, in the spring troll fisheries, which target salmon produced exclusively in Alaska's rivers and hatchery programs, and are not covered under the Pacific Salmon Treaty.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard-accepted, hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
Mariners across coastal Alaska rely on weather data coming from marine buoys to stay safe out on the water. These buoys provide information about water currents, wave height, wind speed, and more. KMXT's Davis Hovey reports that amid shakeups in federal agencies, how that data reaches regular Alaskans could be changing.
Keith Cochran of the Bay Islander checks the marine weather forecast daily before he heads out to fish.
Forecasting has got so good and detailed and precise. I mean, it's a matter of like leaving the dock, you know, 2 hours later or 4 hours later, or slowing the boat down so I get out there at the opportune time.
Cochran, who fishes out of Kodiak in Oregon, is currently fishing for pollock. It's the ubiquitous whitefish's A season in the Gulf of Alaska and is the largest fishery in Kodiak by volume. Cochran scrolls through weather data on his smartphone or on his Time Zero navigation system on his boat. That data is mainly being collected from a network of 3-meter buoys all over Alaska and North America. There are 19 of these weather buoys in Alaska, plus 8 coastal stations on land that record weather data and ocean observations every 10 minutes, 24/7. That data is averaged together over the course of an hour and then transmitted to a satellite that federal agencies pay for. The wider network has roughly 100 weather buoys and 39 tsunami stations across the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean, and international waters. The satellite relays the data to the National Data Buoy Center on Mississippi's Gulf Coast. Part of the center's roughly 30 federal employees and about 100 contractors work in shifts 24 hours a day, combing through the data to help forecast marine weather and monitor for tsunamis.
So we've been here almost 50 years, creating a large number of weather buoys, and we've expanded with time. Certainly part of that expansion is with Alaska.
William Burnett directs the center. Some of the center's staff members have quit as part of the Trump administration's fork in the road offer, while others were fired amid sweeping cuts to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, according to reporting from The Columbian, a newspaper in Washington state. Burnett would not say how many, but he says the remaining staff will be able to maintain the nation's weather buoys and deliver marine data.
From the technicians, the engineers who are designing the buoys, the meteorologists, and oceanographers who are analyzing the data and quality controlling it. It's a 24/7 network, so they're always looking at the data.
After that, it's sent to the National Weather Service's global telecommunications system and distributed in real time through smartphone apps, web pages, and NOAA weather radio for anyone, including Cochrane, to access for free. The agency's data online gets 9 million hits a day, according to Burnett. Cochrane says he's starting to see more and more for-profit marine weather products with subscription models and fees. For example, he pays $10 a month in the summer for a service that helps him fish more efficiently.
When you get into sea surface temperature, chlorophyll, temperature at different areas in the water column, those things we would call premium weather options, or they do call them that, and they charge a lot more for them. Because those are the things that you use to try to go figure out where your fish is going to be or where they're moving or where they're migrating.
There's growing interest from private companies to sell their own marine weather products. Burnett with the National Data Buoy Center says it's not necessarily competitive. He sees opportunities to partner with private companies.
National Data Buoy Center and the National Weather Service operate what we consider to be that backbone foundational network that people can always rely upon to go get observations. But our collaboration with industry partners and the commercial sector will allow us to grow in areas where we may not be able to place observations, and they may be able to collect additional data for us.
But Rick Toman, a former forecaster who worked for the National Weather Service in Alaska for more than 30 years, is skeptical, especially about service to rural Alaska.
Operating in rural Alaska is extremely difficult logistically. And private companies, venture capitalist-funded companies, by definition, are in business to make money. And that's going to be a tough lift in rural Alaska. Could it be done? I guess we'll find out.
In the meantime, Burnett says the center will keep its network of weather buoys, each worth up to $250,000, maintained and operational. The maintenance window for the roughly 100 buoys across North America, including those in Alaska, begins in March and ends in November. Burnett says the center will repair as many buoys as possible in that time frame, and this spring they plan to repair buoys around Kodiak with help from the Coast Guard. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund. In recognition of the fishing industry, which provides more than 50,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source.
The rest of the story. In the wake of our unforgettable, all too recent past, now it may be told. Prior to that most infamous ever 7-Eleven, in June, 8 specially trained terrorists were smuggled into the United States. Not across the Canadian or Mexican borders, but by sea in the middle of the night. Four of them landed in the vicinity of Ponte Vedra Beach, Florida. Four more, Long Island, New York. Dressed as everyday Americans, they had in their pockets among them more than $150,000 in United States currency for expenses and bribes. In ordinary-looking suitcases, they had deadly explosives. Their plan, quite unlike any terrorist plot revealed thus far, was this. The two teams were to rendezvous in St. Louis on the 4th of July. There, camouflaged by the din of celebratory fireworks, they would start bombing stores and factories, electric plants, water supplies, bridges, and more. Their aim was as much to panic the American public as it was to disable vital facilities. And their campaign of terror and destruction was to proceed throughout the nation over a period of 2 years. For the Florida team, everything went according to plan. Consulting transit schedules, they boarded a bus to Jacksonville, continued by train north and west. The New York team was not so fortunate. Shortly after their arrival on that deserted beach, an unarmed Coast Guardsman named John Cullen spotted the group's leader and, suspicious, questioned him. The foreigner slipped Cullen $260 and told him to keep his mouth shut. The young guardsman agreed and walked off into the fog, but promptly thereafter notified his superiors, who in turn alerted the FBI. By then, the New York Four were on a train to Manhattan. But that group's leader, the one who had originally bribed the Coast Guardsman, concluding that the bribe had almost certainly not worked, decided that he would surrender to authorities and rat out his comrades in exchange for leniency. And that plan did work. In no time, the remaining seven would-be terrorists were apprehended. The Florida squad had made it as far as Chicago, and you, until this moment, never knew. Because instead of subjecting the suspects to what's popularly conceived as due process, all eight of them were turned over to a military commission. And as you were utterly unaware, the United States Supreme Court met secretly to determine whether the men in custody could thus be denied the safeguards of the civilian justice system. And the High Court voted, yes, they could. And so, cloaked in complete secrecy, the men were tried. The two who had cooperated with authorities were spared, were deported. The six who had not were executed. And you never knew. And that's not all. At least partly because the slash of that terrible swift sword went unheard, the United States mainland was spared any further threat from foreign terrorists for another half century. For once upon a pair of furtive submarine landings in June of 1942, there were eight prospective German saboteurs prepared to destroy America the Beautiful from the inside. But they, as would a future generation of fear-mongers, overestimated themselves and underestimated us. And now you know the rest of the story.
This is Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Alaska's two U.S. senators split Wednesday on a vote against President Donald Trump's economic tariffs against Canada, the Alaska Beacon reports. The U.S. Senate voted 51 to 48 to approve a resolution that would end the presidentially declared emergency that allowed Trump to impose tariffs on Canada. The vote was largely symbolic because the resolution has almost no chance of passing the U.S. House. Senator Lisa Murkowski joined Senate Democrats and three other Republicans in voting to end the presidential emergency. Senator Dan Sullivan joined all other Republicans in voting to oppose the resolution and support Trump's decision. Murkowski's vote had been expected. In the days preceding the vote, Trump issued a statement asking her and other Republicans to, quote, get on the Republican bandwagon for a change. In response to Trump's policies, British Columbia's government has introduced legislation to permit the province to levy a toll on vehicles traveling from the lower 48 to Alaska. Alaskans used to pay the highest rent in the nation, but new state data show that cost has stabilized. Rent in Alaska was about 50% higher than the national average in 1980. An average household income in the state was also the nation's highest, according to a report in the Alaska Economic Trends magazine. Alaska's median monthly rent cost hasn't grown as fast as other states. State economist Rob Crager co-authored the study. He says that's partially because while Alaska was leading rent costs in the 80s, a drop in oil prices put the state's economy in recession.
We had a huge influx of people coming related to the oil boom in the years that followed. A large number of people who left the state left a lot of that housing inventory in place.
That recession slowed rent increases, according to the report, because many people left the state, making housing more available and affordable. After the recession, several years of negative migration, more people leaving the state than moving in, continued to hinder rent growth. Although slower rent growth was a key takeaway from the report, there are some exceptions. For almost a decade, starting in 2005, the cost of median rent in Alaska grew 42%, according to the report, which was faster than the national average and many states. Krager says more people moved into the state during that period, which drove the demand for housing.
Some of that activity that we saw that was probably the result of things happening down south and things were looking better up here.
Alaska is now at the middle of the pack for rent prices. Median monthly rent in the state, including utilities, was almost $1,400 a month in 2023, the report says, which is about $30 cheaper than the national average. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. A high-priority bill that would substantially boost education funding took another step forward in the state legislature this week. The version of House Bill 69, advanced by the Senate Education Committee on Wednesday, adds a few school policy tweaks and still includes the $1,000 boost to basic per-student funding approved by the House. But as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, Senate leaders say they haven't settled on whether to reduce the funding boost amid a budget crunch.
It's been a constant chorus for years. Alaska schools are underfunded and struggling to do the very basics of educating the state's kids. We've heard about classrooms where there isn't enough room for the kids to all sit together on the rug, and schools where interventions for kids falling behind just aren't happening because there's no money. The Anchorage School District plans to lay off hundreds of staff if funding doesn't rise significantly. The refrain came around the Capitol again just a few days ago.
When I hear education's failing, I say no, education's starving.
That's Lisa Parody. She leads an advocacy group for principals and superintendents called the Alaska Council of School Administrators. She testified at a recent hearing alongside longtime school leaders. Senate Education Committee Chair Lukey Tobin, an Anchorage Democrat, says that's why she maintained the House's $1,000 boost in the bill she moved forward.
We recognize that we need to have a substantial increase to school funding to help starve off so many of the devastating impacts that our districts have been communicating to us.
Here's the thing, though. Well, two things. Three tops. First, the state is facing deficits of, to use a technical term, gazillions of dollars. Close to $500 million for the next year is the latest estimate. We have low oil prices largely to thank for that. And Senate budget hawks have been hesitant to pull from the state's rainy day fund to fill the gap. This year alone would wipe out at least a quarter of what lawmakers have socked away. Reducing the permanent fund dividend is another unattractive option. So the $270 million plus price tag of the education bill is, let's say, difficult. But thing two, is it really that much? Tobin says no. Compared to the status quo, it's about a quarter of that.
To me, $80 million more to help keep some of the programs that we all deeply love in our public school systems, to retain nurses, to keep after-school programs, to keep sports, is a very prudent and reasonable investment in the future of our kids.
As Republicans have pointed out on numerous occasions, lawmakers and the governor have boosted funding in the past few years. It's just been on a one-time basis. Schools got the equivalent of $680 in basic per-student funding last year. So that's Tobin's case. The funding boost looks a lot smaller when you compare it to the status quo. She's hoping that might be an easier pill for budgeters in the Senate to swallow, and that corporate and oil tax increases proposed in the Senate could make it go down even easier. But, of course there's another but, thing three. Lawmakers' objective here is not just about finding a funding level that improves education without breaking the bank. It's also about passing a bill Governor Mike Dunleavy will, unlike last year, actually sign rather than veto. So far, the governor has emphasized the importance of the various policy items in the bill rather than the funding level. He just came out with a new statement on the bill. He says the bill Tobin advanced, quote, doesn't pass muster, in part due to the addition of a testing provision for homeschool students. Senate President Gary Stevens, a Kodiak Republican, says he's hoping to meet with the governor soon to talk things out. But in the meantime,
just reading the tea leaves, I think there's probably a good chance the governor would veto $1,000. And if he does that, then where are we?
Stevens says the debate that's been playing out in this story for the past 3 minutes or so is ongoing within the Senate's Democrat-heavy bipartisan majority caucus. He says they haven't settled on an appropriate dollar figure. And for that matter, neither have some key members of the Senate's minority, like Tok Republican Senator Mike Kronk.
I think that's just something that we're going to hash out. So I'm not saying that it's a perfect amount or it's too high, right? So I think that's something that we have to discuss.
That question is now in the hands of the Senate Finance Committee. That's the bill's last stop before a full Senate vote. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
This is Alaska Public Media.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. I watch them grow. They're like much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And good morning, everybody out here in Southwest Alaska, i.e. Paradise. I'm taking my AV to work today, and it's blowing a little bit and raining like crazy. And I put my hands up in the air, and I look at the sky, you know, I go, is that all you got? And then it's like, when's this going to stop? When's it going to stop? And I started laughing. I go, well, what can I say? This is paradise. It's just the way it goes. I mean, it's the way it is. Anyway, there's nothing better than rain. I mean, think of all these people in California and other places where it doesn't rain, they have forest fires. I mean, poor Los Angeles, my goodness. You know, a lot of it's gone. The worst fire I think they've ever had. We don't have to worry about that. It's just, it doesn't really get any better than this. We're going to start out a little bit different today.
We'll be right back.
got to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friend. I get high with a little help from my friend. Gonna try with a little help from my friend.
Go by. Let's see in the sky with that.
Yeah, we have, of course, opened up with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles. We'll continue. There's a couple pieces I couldn't find in our library, but what the heck. The rest of it's here.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I'd been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? By the fireside, Sunday mornings go for a ride, doing the garden, digging the weeds. Who could ask for more? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? Every summer we can rent a cottage in the Isle of Wight, if it's not too dear. And day.
We never thought of ourselves.
that she made, beating a man from the motor trade. She
Just start to blur. but now you're in gear. Go to a show, you hope she goes. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
Good morning, good morning.
Now, who was probably the most influential person on the Beatles' music?
If you knew Peggy Sue, then you know why I feel blue without Peggy. My Peggy Sue. Oh, well, I love you, Kelly. Peggy Sue, oh how my heart yearns for you, oh Peggy, my Peggy Sue. Oh well, I love you, gal, yes, I love you, Peggy Sue. Peggy Sue, Peggy Sue, pretty, 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 pretty Peggy Sue. Oh. I want you.